The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk, episode 458, to be broadcast Wednesday, October 22nd, 2025, on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk without my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. She's in the other room doing yoga. If you are watching on Facebook Live, feel free to comment. I might be able to respond. Bicycle Talk is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show and you're listening on Facebook Live, you can comment right down here below, or you can send me an email at bicycletalk, the numeral one, at gmail.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. Ron's Rant of the Week: Anti-cycling arguments. Are you as tired as I am from hearing from folks who seem to hate that we are out on the road? Well, guess what? In this episode, I will have the comeback guide to all anti-cycling arguments you'll hear this year. That's probably not all of them, but we'll talk about it. And please feel free to reflect your great comeback argument when you've had to have a discussion with someone who drives a motorized vehicle. Anyway, remember last week I said something about carbon monoxide training? Yeah, well, you heard me right. We're going to talk about that today too. Sure took me by surprise. Anyway, moving on. On the positive side, we're going to have a list today of America's safest cities for cyclists. Say that one five times real fast. And also, get this. Cyclists break far fewer road rules than motorists, finds a new study. Isn't that interesting? That's from our folks over at Forbes magazine. Bicycling has also been confirmed as the most efficient mode of travel 52 years after the study first showed the benefits. And we'll talk about that more in the show. Moving on, Mechanical Minute and Bike Tips, frostbite and cycling. I know it's kind of early to bring this up, but I got to kind of bring it up because we're starting to drop down into the dark times, the dark times, I like to call them. That's when the sun is not as high in the sky anymore, and the days are a little grayer, and they're a little darker, and you know what's coming around the corner. What's coming around the corner is we're going to have winter. And of course, winter is a time that there are people that really do actually ride their bikes in the winter and continue to stay with it. Three major tips of the cycling cap on that one. I just can't even tell you. It's not me. It's definitely not me. I'm just not that hardy. But I know there's a lot of folks that are, and a lot of folks that are primarily because they don't own a motorized vehicle, and this is just what they do. So when is it okay to call it a day and not ride to work or elsewhere? So this is it was just a kind of a fun little clip that I found, and I thought it would be kind of fun to run by you guys. It's okay to check temperature, look outside, and decide that it's better to drive or take public transportation instead of riding your bike to work. Likewise, your day may be better spent on a trainer instead of on the road. Precipitation and mood aside, your main consideration should be time and wind chill. Even with the best equipment, riding in the fall and winter takes longer. If you're in a rush, don't take your bike to work. If you're training, use an indoor trainer. It makes it easier to hit your goals. Either way, you're not going to be tempted to do something dangerous to make up time. And when you ride in the winter, you need to consider the wind chill. There's no wind. If there's no wind, your body heats up the surrounding air, creating a buffer around your skin. Wind blows this buffer away, reducing your skin temperature. That's the best way I've heard it explained so far. Your local forecast includes wind chill based on wind speed. But when you ride a bike, you're creating your own wind. This can quickly lead to frostbite in weather that would normally be comfortable for other outdoor activities. So here's how wind chill relates to exposure times that can cause frostbite. Okay. So say why would you be out in this weather? I don't understand. Negative 28 to negative 39 Celsius, which is negative 18 to negative 38 Fahrenheit. You should only be out for for no more than 10 to 30 minutes max. Negative 40 to negative 47 Celsius, or 40 to 52 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, 5 to 10 minutes, and negative 55 to negative 67 degrees Fahrenheit and below, 2 minutes or less. I would say that I have not really been in negative 67 degree Fahrenheit weather ever in my life, and I don't intend to be. Being one who is of robust size. Now I am too skinny for the cold. I'm sorry. I'm just a little skinny guy and I get cold real quick. I get cold when it's not even cold out, but that's another story. At normal riding speeds, you can get frostbite and temperatures as high as 4 degrees, negative 4 Fahrenheit. That's not very high. This clip must have come from Canada. I can't imagine being out in this kind of weather. I just don't understand it whatsoever. So anyway, folks, here's the thing, you know, don't push yourselves to a limit where you're going to hurt yourself. That seems like common sense, but you know, common sense is really hard to teach. You either have it or you don't. That's the way I've always felt anyway, but, we're going to give an ultimate nod to International Repair Day, which isn't limited just to one day. And this was frame builder Paul Brody produced a video repairing a Ritchie frame. More than anything, it demonstrates how a steel frame can be repaired and go on being a bicycle for many years to come. So there's, This is here. So the story is, fix it, don't ditch it. Right, you know? It's kind of a cool thing. So International Repair Day takes place each year on the third Saturday in October, which was Saturday, October 18th, which was just a few days back. Since 2017, the day has been intended to highlight the value of and importance of repairing things, oftentimes in a community setting at events held all around the world. Perhaps this year, more than ever before, International Repair Day has vital significance, given current economic uncertainty for consumers worldwide who rebel against the planned obsolescence, who want to show respect for their possessions, and who are determined to save items from premature dumping in landfills. Okay, so there's a lot of value of being able to repair your own bike. The money saved in fixing your bike is, you know, it's one thing, but the skills learned by learning how to do it yourself are yours for life. So as many of the guys that I brought through my bike shop have learned over the years, and they also go on to tackle other things too, because the bicycle, it's a good entry-level mechanical, it's a good introduction to mechanics. So anyway, do-it-yourself bike repair, however, it's not without obstacles, which mainly include proprietary product design by brands looking to control their product maintenance, the lack of mechanical aptitude on the part of the product owner. Why care about repair is a chance for us to inform and educate customers and foster brand loyalty. So anyway, there's a number of things you can do here. You can also find community bike repair collectives. You may find bike repair collectives that are out there that will have tools and work stands and knowledgeable people that are hanging out there too that can also help you with it too. So that's something you might want to take a look at. According to Wiki, there are more than 200 bicycle repair collectives worldwide. So this global cycling community helps explain how some brands have outlasted others, sometimes by decades. Community bicycle repair collectives like Biker O-Wave provide workspace tools and equipment to teach people how to build, repair, upgrade, and maintain their bikes. The other thing is we have a local Willimantic Area Interfaith Ministries group that I know they get together maybe once a week, probably in the summer, but not so much this time of year. And they fix old bikes and turn them around to the public for those who can't afford to get a bike. So you can find those too. If you look around, you can find places maybe within your community that might be able to draw you in for a little bit of spare time and start fixing some bikes. And when, the more bikes you fix, I can tell you this by owning a bicycle shop, the more bikes you fix, the better you get at it. So, and the more you get to see. Now, there are some bikes that are truly not fixable. And unfortunately, many of those come from the mass market. They come from the big chain stores, the Big W or the Big T or one of those guys that are, they're selling product that is really not made to last very long, which is really, really sad, but it does happen. But if you've got like an old bike shop quality bike that's still operating well and you can still find some parts for it, then it's a great thing to do. So anyway, the idea behind International Repair Day is fix it, don't ditch it. And we are going to move on from there. The next thing on my list here, okay, carbon monoxide training. You heard it right. I have a hard time believing I'm actually going to talk about this, but there is science out there right now, and it has been out there for a while. But the UCI, the cycling international cycling group has racing group basically has banned the repeated inhalation of carbon monoxide in February of 2025. So there's an outline here how carbon monoxide rebreathing works and why teams are using it. So we're talking about all this different stuff over the years. There's been blood doping. There's been different types of chemicals that riders have been putting in their bodies to make it go faster. But this is a different angle. It's a real different angle. And I don't know that it is easy to test. So not really sure. So the inhalation of carbon of CO will remain authorized within a medical facility and is under responsibility of medical professional experience and the manipulation of this gas for medical reasons and in line with the following restrictions. Only one CO inhalation to measure total HB mass will be permitted. A second CO inhalation will only be authorized 2 weeks after the initial HB measurement. So that's from the UCI. Coaches of cyclists, triathletes, and other endurance athletes are constantly trying to find new and improved methods to gain insight into their athletes' training. These include assessments like continuous blood glucose monitoring and real-time blood lactate testing. Recently, carbon monoxide rebreathing has come into the spotlight, and it brought some controversy along with it. Why would you do this? Anyway, we're going to find out. But what is carbon monoxide rebreathing? How is it used and how does it benefit athletes? So let's take a deep dive in. There's a long history and recent history of carbon monoxide rebreathing. During the second week of 2024 in the Tour de France, Escape Collective released a story on carbon monoxide rebreathing in elite cycling. Writer Ronan McLaughlin revealed that at least three teams were competing in the most prestigious Grand Tour. They were using it to test their athletes' hemoglobin levels. The other outlets picked up on the thread, leading to riders being grilled about the method in their press conferences. Tadej Pogačar, then leading the race, initially said he didn't know anything about it, later clarifying that he misunderstood the question. He said, "It's just a pretty simple test to see how you respond to altitude training. It's not like we're breathing exhaust pipes every day from cars." So, if you're familiar with altitude training, that's I often comment on riders like Sepp Kuss and others that are from Durango, Colorado, and they grew up and live in 8,000 feet. And when you're at 8,000 feet, the air is a little bit thinner, so it therefore your lungs develop in a different way, and your ability to process oxygen develops in a different way. So apparently it is similar to this, but not. So his archrival and eventual tour winner, Jonas Vingegaard, confirmed that his team used carbon monoxide rebreathing as a diagnostic tool, but said there's nothing suspicious about it. However, the media went into overdrive, noting that this is a harmful gas, and it could be abused to gain a performance advantage. So it's nothing new. With all the sudden swirling around carbon monoxide rebreathing, you'd assume it's a relatively recent phenomenon, but in fact, it has been around for over 100 years of history. Oxford scientists John Haldane and Lorraine Smith first developed a way of using it to determine blood volume in a physiology article published in 1900. Haldane later teamed up with his colleague Claude Douglas to study how altitude impacted hemoglobin levels during trials conducted in Tenerife and on Pikes Peak in Colorado. In the 40s, Swedish scientists more accurately calculated blood volumes using carbon monoxide rebreathing and linked this to exercise capacity and cardiovascular function. Two Australian researchers dialed in a simpler method in the 1990s, which was later modified by Nicole Prommer and Walter Schmidt in 2005. Prommer and Schmidt found that the breath-based results could be obtained in just 2 minutes after testing. This led to more teams adopting the approach. So, how does it work? To learn more about carbon monoxide rebreathing, is how it's performed and applied, we have some information here to see what it, he explained that this particular doctor that they talked to explained that carbon monoxide rebreathing is a way to measure blood volume and hemoglobin mass, that's HB mass, in athletes, a topic he's writing a thesis about. Carbon monoxide rebreathing, sometimes performed with an automatic machine, and yeah, you can do it through a more manual process that uses a closed-circuit carbon monoxide rebreather system. First, an athlete typically does a combination of breath and blood tests to measure their baseline carbon monoxide, their levels that before the actual test is performed. The test itself involves the athlete inhaling a small amount of carbon monoxide diluted with oxygen. This mixture is inhaled and exhaled through a closed circuit for 2 minutes. The carbon monoxide the athlete inhales then binds to the hemoglobin in the red blood cells to form carboxyhemoglobin. Carboxyhemoglobin. After 2 minutes, the amount of carboxyhemoglobin, boy, I wish Fran was here for this, that remains in the breath and blood is remeasured and compared to the baseline levels measured at the start of the test. The results are then used to calculate the athlete's total hemoglobin mass. So what is your importance of hemoglobin in mass? As hemoglobin is the main method of transporting oxygen around the body, a higher total hemoglobin mass is often correlated with a higher VO2 max. We've talked about VO2 max often on this show. That's your ability to process oxygen, basically. The VO2 max also depends on other factors such as well-functioning cardiovascular system, lots of blood vessels within the muscle, and abundant mitochondria to extract oxygen from the blood. Being said, in a healthy individual, hemoglobin mass is the most important determinant of their oxygen-carrying capacity. This makes it incredibly useful in evaluating how an athlete responds to training alone or combined with a stimulus like altitude or heat. So, the problem is that if your blood volume goes up and your hemoglobin levels stay the same, your hematocrit comes down. This makes hemoglobin concentration and hematocrit poor predictors of whether the individual's altitude camp was successful or not. Red blood cell count is slightly better indicator, but it still underestimates the impact of altitude on blood volume. This is why carbon monoxide rebreathing is so useful. If you could take all of the hemoglobin in your body and put a scale or and a weight on, and weigh it, that would be the best way of doing it, and it is essentially what carbon monoxide rebreathing does, he said. The result is not affected by what your total blood volume is because you're measuring the actual mass of the hemoglobin. It's not relative to anything else. So this gets very technical. This article gets very technical. And to me, it seems like this is much more, from my evaluation of the article, it seems like it's much more of a testing method to test how well you can process oxygen, very similar to a VO2 max test. And it's an interesting concept, and I don't think that anybody is actually doing it, like sitting down and doing great amounts of carbon monoxide to see if they can, you know, make themselves perform better. But there is a fine edge to whether or not that would be something that could be done, whether it will actually increase your ability to process oxygen better. To me, it seems it's sort of like choking off. It's sort of like, I don't know if you remember seeing years ago when I was racing my bike, we used to have, they had these altitude masks that you could buy, and you could wear an altitude mask while you were training, hopefully on a trainer and not outside, because you're basically starving yourself of oxygen. And by doing that, you were able to build up your VO2 max a little bit quicker. Stop right now just to tell you, nothing replaces good, smart training. Good, smart training is always a great way to go, but there's always someone out there that's going to try to find the shortcut, and that's when you go into that direction, I suppose. I remember I was training a cyclist a few years back, and he was a monster on his bike. He was a big masher, and I got him to bring his cadence way up and stop pushing so hard on the pedals, and got him to really focus more on the whole cardiovascular aspect of cycling. And he increased his speed by 2 miles per hour by the time I was done with him. So, but he was really determined to try to do it the other way. And all he was doing was crushing himself and just making himself slower. But we've talked about that on this show, and we've talked about that over the years. You know, it's you got to let your body rest, and it's just, you know, there's, like I said, there's, this is basically, when the intention is simply to get measurements, there's little difference to evaluating blood glucose, lactate, or any other marker. In terms of scientific accuracy, carbon monoxide breathing is the most precise way of assessing hemoglobin mass and an effective method for determining if an altitude camp was successful. Here's the thing. We wouldn't want this as a legitimate diagnostic practice to be cast aside because of the fear that it was being misused. We need to draw a clear distinction between safe testing that offers no performance advantage and far more frequent inhalation that aims to create some kind of artificial improvement. That's, there it is. There's a statement of statements at the end. If you're using it for testing, it's not a bad idea. If you're using it to increase performance, if you're using it to, I don't even know what we could call this. I mean, we've heard of blood doping. We know about that. We've heard of mechanical doping. That's when you're hiding little motors inside of your bike. We know what that's all about. What would you call this? Really? Carbon monoxide doping? Seems weird. Anyway, that's it. I told you I would talk about it this week, and I did, and that's what I got. And if anybody knows anything about this, or if you have actually tried this, why don't you drop me a line on this? I'd love to read your explanation of what happened, how it worked. You know, where was the science involved? Were you being medically, carefully medically watched and guarded when you did it? Were you being safe? Please be safe. I'd love to hear what's going on. But I think this is primarily a testing method. And now it has come up as, you know, the UCI is looking at it as, well, you know, we'll accept a test a year, but we will not accept you doing this on a regular basis. So apparently there must be riders doing it on a regular basis. That's all I see right now. So just crazy. Let's go on to the next thing on my list here. The list of the safest cities for cyclists proves that safety has nothing to do with luck. So this is a list of America's safest cities for cyclists. And we're going to go down the list here, how they were chosen. Okay, they were chosen. This was compiled by personal injury firm Wagner Rees. They were analyzing fatal crash data from the National Highway Safety Traffic Safety Administration's Fatality Analysis Reporting System. Boy, there's a lot of words there. The study covered nearly 300 U.S. cities and with populations over 100,000, comparing rates of pedestrian and cyclist deaths against state averages and matching them with walk-bike scores to create an overall safety index. The findings show a clear pattern. Cities that have made sustained, data-driven investments in infrastructure and traffic calming policies are seeing real results. In other words, safety isn't luck, it's policy. Nice, huh? And that's why, you know, I talk about this all the time on the show. You got to get out, you got to get loud, you got to get in people's faces about this and try to make those changes because it makes a big difference. It'll make your entire community safer. So the findings show a clear pattern. Cities that have made sustained data-driven investments in infrastructure and traffic calming policies are seeing real results. In other words, it's not luck. So here we are. Number one on the five safest cities for cyclists and pedestrians in 2025. You guys are not going to believe this. You're just not going to believe it. I wouldn't have given this city even a chance at this 5 years ago. New York, New York. Yes, siree, New York City. Once notorious for chaotic traffic and harrowing intersections, New York City now leads the nation in pedestrian and cyclist safety. Since the launch of Vision Zero in 2014, the city has lowered speed limits, redesigned dangerous corridors, and built more than 600 miles of protected bike lanes. The results are striking. Fatalities have fallen, even as the number of cyclists has doubled. Today, you can ride nearly uninterrupted from Bronx to Brooklyn by way of a web of protected lanes, waterfront greenways, and bike priority streets. The infrastructure is far from perfect, but it's proof that even the busiest city in America can make streets safer with the right mix of design and political will. Cool, huh? Second on the list, Irvine, California, in a state where many cities rank among the nation's most dangerous for cyclists, Irvine stands apart as a model of planning done right, built on a master planned grid with wide separated bike paths, multi-use trails, and protected crossings. Irvine consistently reports some of the lowest fatality rates in California. The city's approach has long been about prevention rather than reaction. With extensive off-street pathways connecting neighborhoods to workplaces and schools, it's possible to ride nearly anywhere without entering high-speed traffic, a rarity in Southern California. Number three on the list, again, here we go. And I have known so many people over the years from a long time ago that have been hit in this city. They pretty much say if you ride a bike in this city, you're going to get hit at some point. And this was is because it has a strong student population. It's Boston, Massachusetts, number three on our list. It's transformed from a tangle of cobblestones and chaos to one of the country's most progressive cycling cities. Since adopting its Vision Zero plan in 2015, the city has added dozens of miles of protected bike lanes, introduced slow zones in residential neighborhoods, and implemented raised intersections designed to calm traffic. Boston's dense urban layout works in its favor. Shorter blocks and narrowed roads naturally reduce speed. Combined with an expanding network of protected infrastructure and growing political momentum, Boston is proving that safety and historic streetscapes, can coexist beautifully. Number four on the list, which used to be number one, by the way, I'm just going to mention that, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Cycling advocates have long sung the praises of Minneapolis, and the data backs it up. Decades of investments in protected trails, greenways, and winter-friendly maintenance, yeah, they plow the bike paths, has made it one of the most bikeable cities in the United States. The Midway Greenway, a 5.5-mile sunken urban trail running through the city's heart, remains a gold standard for urban cycling infrastructure. Even in sub-zero winters, the city's commitment to plowing bike paths and maintaining access has helped cycling remain not just visible, but popular year-round. And number five on the list, which used to be on the top of the list, years ago, Portland, Oregon. Portland's inclusion on the safest cities still is no surprise. Often cited as the birthplace of American cycling renaissance, the city's extensive network of bike boulevards, protected lanes, community programs has created one of the strongest safety cultures in the country. Key to Portland's success is its network effect. A focus on connectivity, not just individual bike lanes. Riders can move across the city through a nearly continuous web of low-stress routes. Add in bike-friendly traffic signals, intersection protections, and a vibrant cycling culture, and it's clear why Portland continues to set the standard. I'm going to list the other ones on here just because we're just going to run out of time if I don't. Number six is Seattle, Washington. Number seven, San Francisco, California. Number eight, Madison, Wisconsin. Number nine, Chicago, Illinois. And number 10, Washington, D.C. So what the safest cities have in common? While each of these cities has a unique history and geography, the report identifies five major threads behind their success. Protected, connected networks, not just paint, or what we like to call the toilet paper of bicycle safety. Continuous, separated lanes that form a usable system. Lower speed limits, yay, lower speed limits. Enforcement and design that slows cars by default. Complete streets policies, equitable planning for all road users, not just for drivers, data-driven Vision Zero programs, transparent reporting and measurable goals, and number five, cultural commitment, political will and public buy-in that prioritize safety over convenience. So, this is all good. The lessons from these cities are simple but profound. Safety is choice. It is the outcome of decisions made in city halls, planning departments, and budget committees. When leadership treats cycling as transportation, not recreation, lives are saved. As the report notes, walk and bike scores alone don't guarantee safety. It's how cities connect, maintain, and enforce those networks that determines the real outcome. That's the critical message for the rest of the country, where cyclist fatalities remain unacceptably high. If New York, with its density and its traffic chaos, can bend the curve, then any city can, if it truly commits. That's it. Five safest cities in the United States to ride your bicycle. Big surprises this year. I think it's really impressive And big shout out to NYC for pulling that one off, because I never would have guessed it. Not in a million years would I have guessed that New York would be on the top of the list. So anyway, that's a cool thing. That's why I wanted to discuss it today. Now, since we're talking about safety and all sorts of things that people are doing now that they can ride their bicycle in places like New York City, why the top 8 reasons why people are choosing cargo bikes over cars? What do you think? Yeah, you ever seen one of these cargo bikes? Some of them are really, really impressive. They're just really heavy duty, really, distinct design, multifunctional capabilities. They're just really a different idea in a bicycle. They are not light, but they are built to carry cargo and or people on them. So they have the cargo bike, it kind of changes the game. Not only do they slightly improve the pollution aspect of transportation, but they replace altogether the car option for transportation. Moreover, a recent online discussion on Reddit delves into why so many people are making the switch from cars to these versatile two-wheelers. There's a breakdown here. The top reasons people opt for cargo bikes based on lively conversation. Number one, environmental benefits. That's obvious. The bicycle obviously is not going to impact the environment anywhere near the level of an internal combustion engine. Not to mention other parts of infrastructure, which I think they're not pointed out as much as they really should be, but the weight factor of a cargo bike on a paved street versus the weight of, let's just pick an F-350 pickup truck, just for ha-has. You know, one of those things that, I mean, contractors, I get it. Town workers, I get it. I know why you have to drive those around. I know why you need that type of vehicle. It is a work vehicle and it totally makes sense. But for the average Joe who's driving their car around town because they want to look tough, it's destroying our roads because of the weight of the vehicle. Weight adds up. It really does. So that's another thing that will go in there, as well as the environmental cost efficiency. The financial benefits of owning a cargo bike are significant. Some pointed out the savings on car ownership costs, including insurance, maintenance, and fuel. For many, a cargo bike proves to be a more economical choice, particularly when the vehicle is used for short, frequent trips, while others mentioned saving around $30,000 by selling a car and switching to a cargo bike. I just read something recently, average cost of a car in the United States is over $40,000. Average cost of a new car, it's over $40,000. Getting close to 50, actually. So convenience and time savings. Cargo bikes often outperform cars in terms of convenience, especially in congested urban areas. The ability to navigate through traffic easily and find parking with minimal hassle is a major advantage. One commenter described how biking is quicker than driving in their congested city center, where car traffic and parking are significant challenges. The time saved on short trips and the convenience of not having to search for parking spaces make cargo bikes a practical choice for daily errands. Number 4 on the list, this one's obvious, exercise and health. Yes, you get exercise when you ride a bicycle. And from that, you get the benefits of better health. So, so one commenter here, for example, has not only enjoyed the fun of biking, but also lost weight and improved fitness since acquiring a cargo bike. It's just great. I love seeing the kids on them too. That's really clever. It's very, very cool. Family and child support. Speaking of which, Families Cargo Bikes offer a practical solution for transporting children and their gear. Users have found cargo bikes to be invaluable for school runs, daycare pickups, and other family activities. The ability to carry multiple children along with their belongings makes cargo bikes a popular choice among parents looking for alternative to driving. Number six on the list, fun and enjoyment. Beyond practical benefits, many people simply find riding a cargo bike to be enjoyable. The sense of freedom, the ability to enjoy the outdoors, the pleasure of interacting with others in the community contribute to the appeal. One person described a scenic bike ride that was both relaxing and enjoyable, highlighting how the experience of riding can be more pleasant than driving. Number seven. Reduced stress and hassle. The stress associated with car ownership. Oh my God. Yeah. Including traffic, parking, maintenance is a significant drawback for many, not to mention the unnerving experience of relentless congestion. Cargo bike users report lower stress levels due to the simplicity and reliability of biking compared to driving. One commenter shared how biking has made daily routines less stressful and more enjoyable. Number eight, enhanced social interactions. This is the last piece, I think, on my list. Is it right? Yeah, this is it. So here it is. Cargo bikes also foster a sense of community and connection. Riders often find themselves engaging more with their surroundings with fellow cyclists. One person mentioned how biking in around their neighborhood has led to more social interactions for a greater sense of community. In summary, the decision to switch to a cargo bike is driven by a blend of practical, financial, environmental, and personal factors, from reducing carbon footprints to saving money and enjoying a more active lifestyle, reducing stress. Cargo bikes offer a range of benefits, making them a compelling alternative to the traditional car travel. As more people discover these advantages, it's likely that cargo bikes will continue to gain popularity in urban and suburban settings alike. Are you ready for a cargo bike? It got me all excited. I think it's really cool. I think it's a great idea. What I am seeing in cargo bikes right now is I'm seeing young families. I'm seeing young, healthy families who have decided that they're either ditching one or both cars that they may have had in their driveway and have gone over to the bike instead. And once they figure it out, and once they figure out how to do it safely, and if they have an infrastructure, of course, that supports it, it's a no-brainer. We're talking about huge savings per year. Add up your car payments, add up your insurance payments, add up your maintenance costs, put it all together, and then take a look at a not inexpensive, but very reliable cargo bike. And you'll find that you will have, I did a comparison, a couple of years back when we were comparing the costs and the payback of purchasing a cargo bike that could be many thousands of dollars or will be many thousands of dollars. But as we know, automobiles, motorized vehicles are also many tens of thousands of dollars. So there's a big difference. So anyway, it's definitely something to think about. Definitely is a possibility for some people out there, I'm sure. Let me know how you feel. If you've got a cargo bike, or if you're thinking about getting a cargo bike, got a young family, you want to transport them around, did you figure it out that this is the way to do it? Let me know how you feel. I'd love to hear it. By the way, I will mention that many of the cargo bikes that are out there are generally, they usually have an e-assist system that is connected with them so that you can actually get around with a little more ease, especially when there's any kind of hills involved, or if you're putting a massive amount of weight on the bike too, with either A, tons of groceries, B, a couple of kids on the bike, or C, a couple of kids and massive amounts of groceries, you know. So, you know, but these bikes are built really rugged to be able to handle that. If you have any questions about them whatsoever, go down to your local bike shop and start a conversation. The folks at the bike shop will get real excited because this is something that they don't usually do. And it just brings a sense of, wow, what a cool thing to bring into the store. Let's check it out. Let's see, you know, what we can do to help this customer out. It's all kind of a fun thing. So anyway, as we move on, I will mention a few more things here that I found when I was looking at. Actually, we talked about the comeback guide to all the anti-cycling arguments you're going to hear. So ready for some arguments? Here they are, okay? No one uses bike lanes. Actually, they do, just efficiently. Take Penn Ave in Pittsburgh. You'll see over 400 daily trips, sometimes spiking past 3,700 in a single day. Since installation, that one lane has logged more than a million trips. You might even see it jammed with riders at rush hour, like car lane, because surprise, bike lanes work. They move people quicker and cleaner, and you aren't just sitting behind them idling. In Toronto, bikes actually topped the number of cars on a very central Bloor Street in the summer. Yes, more bikes than cars. I talked about that about a month ago. And in Minneapolis, ridership consistently spikes when safe infrastructure is induced. Build it, and they do come. So that's no one uses bike lane argument. Here's the next argument. Bike lanes take up too much space and make the streets dangerous. They actually make the streets safer for everyone. Data doesn't lie. On streets with protected bike lanes, crash rates typically drop for drivers, cyclists, and pedestrians. When everyone knows where they belong, roads function better. Yes, drivers may need to slow down a bit, but that's not an inconvenience, it's safety. And if you're tired of passing wobbly cyclists on the street in traffic, bike lanes are your solution. They remove the confusion, create predictability, and lower tension for everyone. So they are not more dangerous. I love this one, my favorite. Cyclists don't pay for the roads. Oh yes, the old freeloader fallacy. It's time to retire that one. Most local roads in North America, the ones we bike on, are funded through general taxes like property, income, and sales tax. These aren't user fees. That means whether you drive or not, you help favor the roads. Plus, most cyclists also drive and pay vehicle registration and gas taxes. Many cyclists are subsidizing your driving lifestyle while creating less wear and tear and need less space and reducing emissions. I always just bring back my socialist comment here too, because you know, it's generally the same type of person who's saying cyclists don't pay for the road is against socialism, and yet they drive on the roads which are funded by the government. What is that? Socialism. That's what it is. So if you drive a motorized vehicle, you're a socialist. That's it. That's it. You can't argue that. You just can't. It's not gas tax that pays for the roads. Does not. They should be licensed and insured like drivers. Oh, the insurance companies love that. Licensing scheme for cyclists has been tried and abandoned. They're expensive, hard to enforce. They don't actually increase safety. Unlike 3,000-pound vehicles, bikes aren't deadly weapons. That's why we regulate drivers and not tools. And for those who do ride and drive, auto insurance often extends to bike-related incidents. Already, cyclists already face ticketing and even points on their license in many jurisdictions. The system works and it doesn't need a bloated bureaucracy. Next argument, cyclists never follow the rules. Do drivers? I got another piece coming up here in a minute. Research shows that people break traffic laws across the board. Drivers, cyclists, pedestrians. 2020 Colorado study found that 7-9% of both cyclists and drivers commit infractions. The difference? Motivation. Cyclists often roll red lights for safety to stay visible or ahead of overtaking traffic. Drivers usually do it to save time, and the consequences of a missed signal on a bike might annoy someone. The same in an SUV could be fatal. Context and mass matters. Why don't they just ride on the sidewalk and stick to the trails? Because it's not legal or safe. There you go. In most cities, biking on sidewalks is illegal in business districts. It's dangerous for pedestrians and cyclists alike. And while trails are great, they don't go everywhere. They don't connect to the schools, the shops, or work. You wouldn't accept being allowed to drive on highways. So why does expect a cyclist to stick to the riverfront? Okay, ready? How many more arguments do we have here? Bike lanes hurt small businesses by removing parking. Ah, I love this one. This is one of my favorites. Research from Toronto, New York, and Portland has shown that bike lanes often improve business. That's true, folks. Cyclists shop more frequently than drivers, and a single parking space can be replaced with a rack for 10 bikes. More foot traffic, more local spending. 10 bikes means 10 people, at least, okay? 10 cars means probably not, you know, I mean, it's a big space. It's a big space they take up, and yeah, you might get 10 people out of 10 cars, but they're taking up all that space and creating all that congestion and chaos and mayhem, and that's what it is. So, and think about it. People biking can stop on a dime, park near a door, carry groceries or panniers on a cargo bike. It's not really a threat to small business. It's a lifeline. Helmets should be mandatory. Helmets help reduce injury, of course, but mandatory helmet laws can backfire. They discourage casual riding, lower bike share use, and they often encourage unfairly, they're enforced unfairly, especially in marginalized communities. And if you really care about cyclist safety, the best move is advocating for protected bike lanes, not policing gear. Biking is only for the rich guys in Lycra. Rich white guys in Lycra. There you go. Not anymore. That stereotype was never really totally true. From community co-ops like Pittsburgh's Free Ride to grassroots cycling groups in BIPOC communities across North America, biking is a tool of empowerment and mobility. It's affordable, accessible, increasingly inclusive. The real issue isn't who's riding, it's who feels safe enough to start. Building better infrastructure means more people are riding, not just more confident enough to mix with the cars. The city is too hilly, cold, rainy, the two disease. Too much of this, too much of that, too. Well, guess what? Turn that off. E-bikes and modern gear have changed everything. Hills, handling, rain, wear a jacket, snow. Cities like Montreal and Minneapolis are embracing year-round bicycling. You don't have to ride everywhere, but for short trips around the neighborhood, most people can do more than they think. We can't all be expected to bike. That's fair. That's not a point, though. Not everyone can or wants to bike, but some people can and do, and they deserve a safe, efficient, affordable way to move around a city. You want cleaner air, less traffic, more vibrant streets, and safer communities? Support better biking infrastructure. Final thought. Bikes aren't the problem. They're part of the solution. If you're angry at traffic, pollution, the cost of living, parking shortages, or road safety, bicycles aren't your enemy. They're your ally. Making space for them isn't about punishment. It's about progress. So the next time someone launches into a tired anti-bike rant, smile. You've got the facts, the stats, and the stories to ride circles around them. That's it. That's my answer to the arguments. And then I have a very short thing here because I'm going to run out of time completely. A new study from the Danish Road Directorate shows that less than 5% of cyclists break traffic laws while riding, yet 66% of motorists do when driving. The Danish Cycling Embassy, privately funded NGO, puts this down to visibility. Law-breaking by cyclists, easy to notice for everyone, but transgressions by motorists, such as speeding, are harder to spot. The study was carried out by the Danish government consulting firm Rambol, using video cameras and sighted at major junctions in Danish cities, including Copenhagen. It was found that just 4.9% of cyclists broke road rules when they were riding on cycleways. And that rose to 14% of cyclists when there was no cycling infrastructure present. Want fewer scofflaw cyclists in your city? Install cycleways. Yeah, video cameras counted 28,579 cyclists crossing at intersections. The most frequently recorded transgression was a bicycle on the sidewalk. Rule breaking by cyclists was twice as numerous in smaller cities in which Denmark have fewer cycleways. The new study had almost identical results to an early one carried out by the consulting firm Copenhagenese. This was also a video study and analyzing behavior of 80,000 cyclists that found that 5% broke traffic laws. Separate studies in the Danish Directorate found that two-thirds of motorists routinely flout the law, with breaking local speed limits and being the most common offense. Ah, so cyclists are safer. That's good. Okay, what do we got here? We got the end of the show coming up, and I have just really kind of run out of things, but I am going to run real quick by you. The Grand Départ of the 2026 Tour de France is going to take place in Barcelona. The first stage will be team time trial. The second stage, a hilly race from Tarragona back to Barcelona. And so that will be that. And then we have the Giro kicks off in Bulgaria next year. Beyond that, it's little known for now, but some of the rumors are really are doing the rounds, not nearly as loud as the speculation around the Tour de France. But still, what about the return of Zancolan, for instance? We're rounded up the latest whispers of the possible route for the 2026. And so anyway, that's it. The big races, they're already being planned. They already have their departing places, and we'll get a little bit more on that, including the fact that I have the UCI 2026 calendar already sitting in my database here. So yeah, all the races are already laid out. As far as racing right now, it's really coming down to a slow, slow time. We are transitioning over into cyclocross because it is the fall winter sport, and there'll be a lot of that coming up real, real soon. And I will be reporting on that too. We'll see how our great cyclocross stars that had done so well on some of these grand tours, we'll see how they do this fall and winter and what kind of fitness they're in. Personally, I think they need a break, but who am I to say? That's not my decision. That's a coaching decision. That's a training decision, and we will see what the deal is there. So there's also a new study out, and I'll put this in next. This is the next week. Suggests that cyclists are better people than drivers. That's a funny thing. Anyway, back. Let's go over here to let's go back here to our finishing points and events. Project Mayhem Cyclocross Series is still going on. There's still two to go. The Massachusetts series has come to an end as of this past weekend. The 2026 UCI calendar is out right now, so you can check that out through a number of outlets. And finishing points, carbon monoxide training. Really? Really? That just seems silly to me. But you know what? There's some science to it. So study it. Let me know what you think. Get back to me. And are you ready to train in that car for a cargo bike? What do you think? Are you ready for the cold? Give me your opinions. I want to hear it. I want to know what's going on. Remember, bicycling is freedom. Life is better for everyone when more people ride bikes. Cycling is an easier, safer option for more people because more people bike, people are happier, healthier, and our communities are safer and friendlier, and our planet is greener. Together, we can help more people enjoy the love of cycling. I'll say it again, it won't be my last time. Get loud, get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic and dangerous roads and do your part. Get out and talk to your local town, your local government, and maybe you should take the Pedal and Run Challenge. Park your car, ride your bike instead. You really may surprise yourself. Always be safe and kind. The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. You have been listening to Bicycle Talk, and if you want to know more, you can send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. This is Pedal and Ron. Remember, keep that rubber side down on the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It just really could save your life. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Get on your bikes and ride!